Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So, as Father Thomas mentioned, this talk is called Dividing and Relating the Sciences in Aquinas. And so I'm going to do some of the things that I say are going to overlap in hopefully interesting and mutually reinforcing ways with some of the things that Dr. Gorman said earlier today. I'm also going to be engaged in a project of translating Tomish, into sort of more ordinary everyday speak. And but my approach is going to be a little bit more methodological than his approach. One thing, what I will not be discussing in this lecture is a so-called hierarchy of the sciences. So is it possible to order the different disciplines in kind of a hierarchical list from best to worst? Yes, it is. I'm not going to be interested in doing that today. My goal is not to sort of like be a metaphysical triumphalist or something like that. Rather, what I want to do is talk about how to divide them and then how to relate them. So this talk has three very simple goals. First, I want to clarify for you the meaning of the term science as it appears in Aquinas and contrast that with the way that we ordinarily speak of science. Then I want to walk you through Aquinas's principled divisions between the kind of the basic genera or the broadest kind of classifications of science. And then I'll introduce you to the basics of his theory of what are called mixed or subalternated sciences. But on that point, I'm going to leave much of the hard work to Dr. Brian Carl for later on in the talk. So this is great. So I get to build off of what Professor Gorman has done, and then I get to punt all the really hard stuff to Professor Carl later on, and I get to occupy the sort of happy, virtuous mean. Okay. So first, the meaning of science. This may seem very, very basic and obvious, but science, in Aquinas's language and in his philosophical and theological approach, does not mean what we ordinarily mean in English with the word science, right? So he had the word scientia. Scientia has a history in Latin and a very precise technical meaning that he gives it in the context of what he calls the intellectual virtues. I'm not going to talk about the broader intellectual virtues here and now, but if you want to ask about it later, we can talk about that. For our purposes, there are two important points of difference. So first, when Aquinas talks about the science of nature, the science of mathematics, the science of metaphysics, the science of medicine, etc., etc., his use of the word does not necessarily involve or require observation or experimentation, which I think for most people, kind of in the ordinary, everyday English speak, the word science, those are things that if they're not part of the very definition of the word in ordinary English, they're at least part of the connotation of the word in ordinary English, right? But they're not even part of the connotation of the word science for Aquinas. Aquinas's scientia, or science, also doesn't necessarily involve the physical world at all. So one of the things that came up in the first talk this morning was the distinction between mathematics and natural philosophy or natural science for him. More on that later, but mathematics for him doesn't necessarily involve the physical world, at least in order to be understood. Nevertheless, mathematics is a kind of paradigmatic science for him. So what does science mean for Aquinas, or scientia? It means this: a stable disposition of the mind to draw necessary conclusions. So a science for Aquinas is a stable disposition of the mind to draw necessary conclusions. Let's break that down. First, stable disposition of the mind. So the first thing to note here is that this already commits Aquinas's understanding of science or scientia to being what we can call in contemporary philosophy of science internalist rather than externalist. Here's what this means, roughly. For Aquinas, science is not an external body of knowledge, right? So where is science for Aquinas? It's not in a book. It's not on a board. It's not even on a PowerPoint, right, with screens that are slightly too small, right? Where is science? It's internal to the practitioner of science rather than external, right? So science is a habit of mind of an agent of scientific inquiry and investigation. So that's where science is. That having been said, this is not, and this is extremely important, the fact that it is subjective in the sense that it's internal to a subject doesn't mean that it's somehow relative, right? So Aquinas's notion of science has all the objectivity of our current, ordinary, everyday English use of the word science. In fact, as I'll show in just a moment, it might have more objectivity than our ordinary, everyday English notions of the word science. It's this point about internalist versus externalist is just about where do you locate science. It's not a kind of external body of knowledge, not even a kind of body of knowledge that societies or communities of practitioners have developed. It's inside, you know, it's in the mind of the scientist. It's also important to note that that here it's a stable disposition of the mind. So what is scientia or science for Aquinas? It's a disposition to think in a certain kind of way. It's not an act of thought, right? So you can have acts of science, but what is the science? The science is a shaping of the mind, a habituation of the mind, or a disposition to think in a particular way. I like to use this example. You know, Father Thomas Davenport got a PhD in theoretical particle physics, so he's like not bad at math. Father Humbert Kilinowski got a PhD in math, so he's like better at math. And then I could probably prove the Pythagorean theorem if I like sat down and remembered hard enough, right? But give the three of us a math problem, right? I can maybe figure it out as long as it's not super hard. His mind is disposed to answer that problem, to give the proof in a way that mine isn't, and Father Humbert's mind is disposed to give the proof in an even more intense, sort of almost immediate way than Father Davenport's, right? So this disposition of the mind or habituation of the mind admits of degrees. You can be more or less disposed. Which roughly one way to think of it is if you want a very crude analogy, if you think of the mind as kind of like a spring, right? It can be, you know, if you've only sort of pushed down the spring a tiny little bit, then it's, you know, it will only spring a tiny little bit. But if you push it down all the way, it is prone to react, right? As the moment you remove your hand, right, it will spring, right? You know, so when Father Humbert is saying mass, he has to actively stop himself from doing math, right? When Father Thomas is saying mass, he, like, if something mathy really kind of jumps out at him, he has to hold himself back, right? You know, I have no problem saying mass, right? So this is the point about a disposition to think, which admits of more or less. You can be more or less prone or disposed to think in certain kinds of ways. But none of those more or less among the dispositions is the same thing as a particular act of thought. Okay, so you've got stable disposition of the mind. Now the next part of the definition is to draw. So here I just want to highlight that this is a discursive rather than an intuitive kind of thinking. There are certain kinds of thoughts that we have that are just, in Aquinas' language, immediate thoughts. Right? That's not a temporal sense of immediate for him. It's an etymological sense of immediate. It means unmediated or very literally unmiddled. Right? So you're not thinking through one thought to another thought. You're just thinking the thought. That's intuitive. For him, discursive thought is when you're thinking through one or two thoughts to another thought. That's discursive reasoning. And so science for him is not a stable disposition of the mind to intuit. That's a different kind of intellectual virtue for him. Science is a stable disposition of the mind to engage in discursive reasoning, right? So to reason to a thought through other thoughts. And the particular thought that you're reasoning to and the particular thought that you're reasoning through is unique for Scientia. You're reasoning to necessary conclusions. And the way that you get there is through necessary premises, right? So here's a perfectly valid kind of reasoning, right? If Father Humbert sees a shape on the altar, then he will start doing math. But Father Humbert sees a shape on the altar, so Father Humbert starts doing math, right? Now, is it necessarily the case that if Father Humbert sees a shape on the altar, then he starts doing math? I mean, actually, if you know Father Humbert, yes, right? Is it necessarily the case that Father Humbert does see a shape on the altar? No, right? You know, he can, if he's really focused, he cannot attend to shapes, right? Just one note, if anybody here is sort of has any kind of familiarity with like contemporary Anglophone philosophy of science, and so you may have run across people who are trying to kind of force scientific inquiry into like the formal methods of contemporary syllogistic logic, the kind of necessity involved in the conclusions that are scientifically drawn for Aquinas, it's not the necessity of the box modal operator in contemporary modal logic. If you want to think of it as anything, it might be something like a by nature operator. So the idea is this: look, massive bodies necessarily attract. Does that mean that in every instance, when you've got a massive body and another massive body, they're moving towards each other? No, right? What it means is massive bodies are by nature attracted to one another, and so they will attract unless that natural aptitude is inhibited by something, right? So like, a stronger than gravitational force in a different direction, right? So the necessity in question here is not, a necessity that like never admits of a counterexample. It's the necessity of the natures of things, right? So dogs by nature have four legs, right? Fish by nature have no legs, right? Can you find, a dog that has been in a car accident and has three legs? Of course, right? Is that a counterexample to to Aquinas' sense of necessity that attains in cases of scientific reasoning? No. So science for Aquinas is the stable disposition of the mind to draw necessary conclusions, right? So conclusions about things where they have this force of necessity, right? That the thing we're talking about, the kinds of properties or features that things have, the kinds of activities that things engage in by nature as opposed to by chance. So you can talk about, right, like certain chemicals by nature engage in the following kinds of reactions, but can you inhibit the reaction? Sure you can, right? And some of you like do research where like inhibiting certain chemical reactions is like your job. It's what you get paid to do, right? But the reason why you get paid potentially big bucks to do that is because it's hard to inhibit the natural reactions of things, right? Things want, not in a cognitive, intentional sense, right, but in this teleological tendency sense, right? Things have natures, and by their natures, they tend to act in certain ways. That's the kind of necessity, the necessity of natural aptitude that we're talking about. Now, for Aquinas, there are two ways of achieving this sort of science in this technical sense of drawing necessary conclusions from necessary premises. roughly we can think of this as, so if science is like real gold standard knowledge, then it comes in two kinds. There's knowing that, and there's knowing why. So it's one thing to know that something is true. It's another thing to know why something is true. It's one thing to know that there is smoke on the mountain. It's another thing to know why there is smoke on the mountain. For Aquinas, knowing that, this is what he calls in Latin quia, scientia quia. Whenever we know that something is true, but we don't know why it's true, we are still drawing necessary conclusions, right? We are understanding the way that things are naturally apt to act and to be. But the way that we're thinking does not track the causal structure of the world, right? So our reason for drawing the conclusion that is, in fact, necessary need not map on to the real-world causal explanation of the thing that we're knowing. So I offer you these two examples. So here's an example of reasoning that. Everything capable of laughter is a rational animal. But every human being is capable of laughter. Therefore, every human being is a rational animal. So this is a syllogistic line of reasoning. And the thing that we're knowing is the fact that every human being is a rational animal. How are we drawing that conclusion? Well, on the basis of the premises, right? So you've got two premises. Everything capable of laughter is a rational animal, and every human being is capable of laughter. So suppose, so start with the second premise. Every human being is capable of laughter, right? But like, what about infants in the womb, right? They don't laugh, you say. Devastating counterexample. No, it's not. Why? Because remember what I just told you. The sense of necessity involved here is not the in every instance across all possible worlds, right? It's just the sense of the necessity of natural aptitude. So that child in the womb, is it the sort of thing that is naturally apt to be able to laugh? Yes, it is. Is a rock the sort of thing that is naturally apt to be able to laugh? No, it's not. So it's that sense of, so it's necessarily the case that certain organisms bear within themselves the capacity for laughter, even if under certain circumstances, like being in the womb or being asleep or being in a persistent vegetative state, right, they don't in fact exercise that capacity, right? They're still the sorts of things that by nature engage in that, are apt to engage in that kind of activity. So number two is necessarily true, right? Just given human beings. And number one is necessarily true. And I mean, here's a proof, right? So at least two things are required to laugh. One is like having vocal cords and being able to make the sound. Two, being able to get the joke. So angels can get the joke, but they don't have vocal cords, can't laugh. Right? Dogs have the vocal cords, can't get the joke, right? So a parrot can literally parrot laughter, but it can't laugh, right? So both of the premises are necessary. The conclusion follows. It's a valid line of reasoning from the premises. So we have just drawn a necessary conclusion, namely that every human being is a rational animal. We have not explained why every human being is a rational animal. Your capacity to laugh is not the explanation why you are a rational animal. Rather, it's the reverse. So look at the knowing why line of reasoning. If you flip the way that you're thinking around and you reason in this way, every rational animal is capable of laughter, but every human being is a rational animal, therefore every human being is capable of laughter, now you don't just know that it is necessarily the case, necessarily true, that every human being is capable of laughter. You know why every human being is capable of laughter. Why? Because our capacity to laugh is explained by, in the real world, right? The causal explanation of our capacity to laugh is the intersection of our rationality and our animality. Right? Our animality gives us the vocal cords. our rationality gives us the ability to get the joke. And that is what explains our capacity for laughter. Why are human beings the sorts of things that are naturally apt to laugh? Because human beings are rational animals. And rational animality is what's required for the capacity to laugh. Do you see the difference? Another example that I could give you that I kind of alluded to in passing earlier would go like this. Wherever there's smoke, there's fire. There's smoke on the mountain, therefore there's fire on the mountain. I know that it's not actually necessarily the case that wherever there's smoke, there's fire, but just give me that one, right? I've given you the real example here, but just to like to generate a few more examples, right? You can reason from the presence of smoke on the mountain to the presence of fire on the mountain, but smoke is not the reason why there's fire on the mountain, right? Smoke is not the real world cause of fire. Flip it, wherever there's fire, there's smoke. There's fire on the mountain, therefore there's smoke on the mountain, right? Now all of a sudden, wait a minute. The way that you reasoned does have isomorphy with the causal structure of the world, right? In the world, the fire really is the cause of the smoke, right? And in your thinking, the fire is the cause of your drawing the conclusion about smoke. So that's the difference between science that and science why, right? So you have science that, just as long as you really are drawing a necessary conclusion from necessary premises, but there's no isomorphy between the way you're thinking and the causal structure of the world. In knowing why, you're drawing necessary conclusions from necessary premises, but there's isomorphy between the line of thought and the line of causality in the world. Okay. So, to know that, all that's required is a necessary connection, whereby necessary we mean this natural aptitude. To know why, that necessary connection also has to be causally explanatory. So the first principles of our reasoning have to be either real causal definitions of things, where causal here means what Professor Gorman was talking about this morning, so you could use any of the relevant four causes, and kind of primitive causal connections. So like rational animal and capacity for laughter. Knowing why is, for Aquinas, the gold standard of all knowledge, right? That is the paradigmatic best kind of knowledge that we can acquire. But knowing that is still real, genuine science for him. Okay, now, with that understanding of what a science is, let's divide them. For Aquinas, the division between sciences can be approached both materially and formally. The material division of the sciences is what, in contemporary speak, we might call an extensional division. So it has to do with which things get studied in different sciences. So for example, plants, and again, I apologize about the smallness of the screen. Plants get studied in biology, in botany, sorry. Animals get studied in zoology, and both get studied in biology. So there's a difference in the extension or scope of the things studied in each of those sciences. So why is botany not zoology? Well, a material explanation is they study different things. Why is biology not botany or zoology? Well, they study different things. And note, an extensional difference can also, you know, is compatible with inclusion, right? So all the things studied in botany and all the things studied in zoology are studied in biology. It's just the reverse is not the case. A formal division of the sciences is, to use the kind of technical language, an intentional division, not an extensional division. So here, this has to do with the way in which the things that are studied get studied in those different sciences. So, for example, medicine studies things from the perspective of how they do or don't contribute to health. Aerospace engineering studies things from the perspective of how they do or don't contribute to the flight worthiness of a man-made object. Biology studies things from the perspective of life. And it's important to note that the material and formal divisions are neither contradictory nor exclusive. In fact, it often happens that they're mutually entailing. So for example, if you take a formal approach to biology, right, it studies things from the perspective of life, which means that from an extensional or material perspective, that formal perspective is going to exclude stuff, right? So chairs, since they are not alive, are not legitimate subjects of biological inquiry. Why? Because biology studies things from the perspective of life, and chairs aren't alive. So the material and the formal approaches are supposed to be compatible with one another, not autonomous. So here's what Aquinas' material division of the sciences looks like. So first he divides so you can have scientific knowledge of things that are not purposefully produced by man. Those are what he calls speculative sciences. Or you can have scientific knowledge of things that are purposefully produced by man. Those are practical sciences. So medicine is a practical science for him. He didn't have aerospace engineering, but aerospace engineering would be a practical science for him, right? Chemical engineering would be a practical science, right? By contrast, the speculative sciences, those are extensionally divided in the following way. Metaphysics studies everything that's real. Mathematics studies everything that's measurable or quantifiable. And natural philosophy or natural science studies everything that's changeable. Where change means what Dr. Gorman explained in his talk this morning. So, the actualization of a potency where the form that's acquired is exclusive of some other form. Aquinas's formal division of the sciences works in a slightly different way. So you get the same divisions, but here he appeals to different principles through which knowledge is gained. And so I should say here on this slide, I'm focusing on just on the speculative sciences. So the formal division of practical sciences is based on the purpose. So remember, all of the practical sciences, that's scientific knowledge of things that are purposefully produced. Right? But we can have lots of different purposes in producing things. And those different purposes give a different kind of formality, he says, to the different practical sciences. So health is one purpose, right? Flightworthiness is a different purpose, right? And so if your purpose is to produce something flightworthy, you're engaged in aerospace engineering. If your purpose is to produce something healthy, you're engaged in medicine. So among the practical sciences, it's the purpose, the final cause, that actually introduces a formal distinction. What about for the speculative sciences? So when we're not trying to make something for our own ends, right? We're not trying to kind of like pragmatically manipulate the world around us. We're just trying to understand things. Here, he says, and again, I have to thank Professor Gorman for kind of setting me up and doing part of the heavy lifting. So for him, physical reasoning or natural reasoning means knowing things through principles that are strictly material. And what does strictly material mean? It means the principles that are through which you're knowing the conclusions involve matter both to be and to be understood. Right, so a cow is something that there are no immaterial cows, right? In order for there to be cows, they have to be material. But also, you can't even understand cow without understanding matter. Mathematical reasoning, by contrast, involves knowing things through principles that are partly material and partly immaterial. And here, like Professor Gorman said, the principles involved require matter to be, but not to be understood. So, for example, the notion half, right? the only haves that exist are halves of material things. You can have half a pizza, you can have half a cake, you can have half a pie, right? But again, pace Plato, you can't have just like half in itself, right? There's no such thing. There is no such thing. It doesn't exist. But you don't have to understand pizza or pie or cake or whatever in order to understand the concept half, right? And mutatis mutandis, that's going to hold for all other mathematical concepts, right? So so for Aquinas, mathematical concepts, what he calls mathematicals, they're just the sorts of things that you don't need matter in order to understand them, but they do need matter in order to be. Metaphysical reasoning means knowing things through principles that are strictly immaterial. So these are principles that involve neither matter, so they involve matter neither to be nor to be understood. So one example that, again, Professor Gorman used this morning was substance. Here's another, right? A potency or potentiality, right? So the angels can think different thoughts, right? So the Archangel Gabriel right now might be actually thinking what a great presentation this is, right? But at the very same time that he's actually thinking about how great this presentation is, he's also potentially thinking about, like, God, right? Potency is not something that requires matter in order to be. There are immaterial potencies. And it certainly doesn't require matter in order to be understood. So, how does this give you different kinds of reasoning? Let me give you some examples. So here's a bit of physical reasoning. Everything with tactile organs and a nervous system is irritable. All animals have tactile organs and a nervous system, so all animals are irritable. Here's a bit of mathematical reasoning. All shapes are bound continuous quantities, but all triangles are shapes, so all triangles are bound continuous quantities. And here's a bit of metaphysical reasoning. All actualities are more perfect than their corresponding potentialities, but all forms are actualities. Therefore, all forms are more perfect than their corresponding potentialities. Note that in all three cases of syllogistic reasoning, there are three terms. A major term, so that's the term that appears in the major premise or the first premise and doesn't appear in the minor premise, the second premise. There's a middle term, so a term that appears in both premises, and there's a minor term, which appears only in the second premise, not in the first premise. So I have color-coded them for you. So the major terms are the things in red, the middle terms are the things in blue, and the minor terms are the things in green. So column one, again, forgive the smallness of the lettering. Column one is an instance of purely physical reasoning. Why? Because all three terms are physical, right? So tactile organs in a nervous system cannot exist without matter and cannot be understood without matter. Irritability, so a responsiveness to stimuli, cannot exist without matter, cannot be understood without matter. Animal cannot exist without matter, cannot be understood without matter. Shape can be understood without matter, but can't exist without matter. Bound continuous quantity can be understood without matter. You don't have to think bound bronze continuous quantity or bound clay continuous quantity. I'm spending a lot of time with my nieces and nephews recently, so Plato for me is like the paradigmatic example, right? So I can make a bound continuous quantity out of Plato, but in order to think bound continuous quantity, I don't have to think Plato or literally any other matter. And mutatis mutandis for triangles. Actuality, that can exist without matter and can be thought without matter. the notion more perfect than a corresponding potentiality can exist without matter, can be thought without matter. Form can exist without matter, can be thought without matter. So column one is an instance of purely physical reasoning, column two is purely mathematical reasoning, and column three is purely metaphysical reasoning. Now mixing. What happens when we mix the different sorts of terms together in a single line of thought? So I'm going to give you three mixed cases. So case one, every principle of life is a principle of motion. Some forms are principles of life. Therefore, some forms are principles of motion. In that case, the major term and the middle term, right? So principle of life and principle of motion, those are both physical. They can't be thought without matter, and they can't be without matter. But the minor term, form, is metaphysical. Form can be without matter and can be understood without matter. Mixed case two. Every speed is a distance divided by time. Every local motion has a distance divided by time. So every local motion has a speed. In this case, the major and the middle terms are both mathematical. So speed is mathematical and distance divided by time is mathematical. But the minor term is physical. Local motion can't be thought without matter. And it can't be without matter. Case three, every being is made of Platonic solids. So, I mean, this is strictly speaking false, but let's just play kind of Plato's Timaeus here. So every being is made of Platonic solids. Every star polyhedron, and if you're going to be really nitpicky, which you should, every regular star polyhedron is a being. Ergo, every regular star polyhedron is made of Platonic solids. So two and three are both true. So in this case, the major term and the minor term, right? So made of Platonic solids and regular star polyhedron, those are both mathematical. They don't require matter in order to be understood, but they do require matter in order to be. Whereas the middle term, being, that's metaphysical, right? Being can be and can be understood without matter. So what do we do with those cases? For Aquinas, the middle term is the thing that matters most. So here I've blued the middle terms, right? So remember, the middle term is, you can think of the middle term as like, it's the ultimate principle of your reasoning because it's the thing that's doing all the work, right? So it's the thing that connects the first two premises, the first two thoughts, and then gets cut out, right? You cut out the middleman when you draw the conclusion, right? So for Aquinas, the middle term is what matters most. So look at column one. In column one, the middle term is physical. So what we have here is a case of formally physical or natural scientific reasoning about something materially metaphysical, right? So the conclusion drawn, the subject of the conclusion drawn is form, right? So some forms. And from a material perspective, form is metaphysical. But the way that you're reasoning about form in this line of thought is natural scientific for Aquinas. Why? Because the middle term, the real principle through which you're drawing the conclusion, is a term of natural science, right? It's a principle for knowing the conclusion, and that principle is a purely material principle, right? Principle of life. In case two, since the middle term is mathematical, you have a case of formally mathematical reasoning about something that is materially physical, right? So the conclusion that we've drawn is about every local motion, right? And local motion is physical, right? But the way that you're reasoning about local motion is mathematical. Why? Because the middle term through which you're drawing your conclusion is distance divided by time, right? That's a mathematical notion. In case three, since the middle term is metaphysical, being, it's a case of formally metaphysical reasoning about something that is materially mathematical. Regular star polyhedrons, not sphere. There was an earlier version of this that I got excited about regular star polyhedrons and then added them in and then didn't fix that. So you're thinking about these mathematical objects in a metaphysical way, right? So the formal aspect is metaphysical, even if the thing that you're thinking about, materially speaking, is physical, right? So all of this, for Aquinas, none of this is problematic. All of this is totally fair game for how we reason about different kinds of things. So, just as it's possible for a line of reasoning that's scientific to be mixed, Aquinas also thinks it's possible for an entire science to be mixed, right? So it's possible for your mind to be stably disposed or habituated to draw conclusions in a mixed way. These are what Aquinas calls the subalternated sciences, about which Dr. Carl will speak later. I'll just say a few kind of introductory things. First, the word subalternation, weird, not an active or maybe even passive ordinary English vocabulary word, right? So it comes from traditional or scholastic logic. So in logic, a proposition X is subaltern or subalternated to a proposition Y, just in case Y's truth guarantees X's truth, and X's falsity guarantees Y's falsity. So all sea monsters have scales. If that's true, it guarantees the truth that some sea monsters have scales. Likewise, if it's false that some sea monsters have scales, that guarantees that it's false that all sea monsters have scales. So the proposition, strictly speaking, the I proposition, some sea monsters have scales, is subaltern or subalternated to the A proposition, all sea monsters have scales. Weirdly, something similar can happen with respect to sciences. And this happens when the core axioms of, or at least some of the core axioms of one science, are drawn from the conclusions of some other science. So it will make the science that receives core axioms subaltern or subalternated to the science that gives it those axioms. For Aquinas, mathematics is almost always the subalternating science, the big one, and some branch of natural philosophy is almost always the subalternated science. So for example, optics, the science of light, and astronomy, the science of the heavenly bodies, are, in Aquinas' mind, very frequently subalternated to geometry. Right? So you have to use geometrical principles. You have to invoke principles of geometry in order to explain the motion of the heavens and in order to explain the lines of sight. Music, which he thinks of as the science of harmony, where harmony means something slightly different than what we mean, is almost always subalternated to arithmetic because it depends on ratios. It's really hard to do music without math. It's really hard to do optics and astronomy without math. And so in that sense, all of those sciences are subalternated to either geometry or arithmetic. But he does think there are other examples. So sacra doctrina, or sacred theology, is, he thinks, subalternated to something that he kind of enigmatically calls the science of God and the blessed. So one way you can think of it is this. If you're doing real, like, Catholic theology and not just, like, storytelling time or emoting or something like that, which is... I'm not an academic professional theologian, so I get to bash on professional academic theologians all the time. So, you know, most professional academic theology is just storytelling at this point, unless you're in these hallowed halls. But for Aquinas, it's not. It's rigorous scientific thinking, right? But it's rigorous scientific thinking where some of the core axioms of the science, right? So think like book one of Euclid's Elements, right? If you were to structure sacred theology like book one, like Euclid's Elements, what would book one be? Book one would be the articles of faith, right? So propositions that we believe as to be necessarily true because God has revealed them, right? In just the same way that somebody who does, or in roughly the same way that somebody who does astronomy, right, can just onboard things that the mathematician and the geometer tell them are true, right, and then employ, right? If you're onboarding and employing, you're doing a subalternated science. Now, it is important to point out that if that is what you're doing, if you're onboarding truths from some other scientific discipline and then just employing them, and if your mind is stably disposed to do that, that will only yield scientific knowledge that. It will never yield scientific knowledge why, right? So if you're always involved in a project of where at least one of your premises is received from another discipline, then you won't ever have the explanation why for that premise. And so you'll always be, you will be able to draw necessary conclusions, right? Real rigorous scientific thinking, right? On Aquinas' understanding. It just won't be the paradigmatic case. So subalternated sciences are real sciences. Mixed sciences are real sciences. They're just not like really the best kind of science or explanation. So to conclude, we've seen that that Aquinas distinguishes between the following three things. First, he distinguishes scientific knowledge that from scientific knowledge why. We've seen that he distinguishes subalternated sciences from subalternating sciences, right? Where the subalternating one is the one that gives principles, and the subalternated science is the one that receives principles. And we've seen that he distinguishes between mixed lines of reasoning and pure lines of reasoning. All of that, it turns out, taken together, makes a lot of room for a high degree of variability with respect to the interrelation between different domains and methods of scientific inquiry, right? So you can have a pure, non-subalternated natural science. You can do natural science in a pure, non-subalternated way, where all your lines of reasoning are unmixed. You can do natural science in a subalternated way, where basically all of your lines of reasoning are invoking some kind of mathematical premise, right? So it's pure, it's completely subalternated. But you can also do natural philosophy in a way where some of your lines of reasoning are pure and some of your lines of reasoning are mixed, right? And it might even be the case that some things that we identify as different natural sciences vary in degree here, right? So maybe what this man does, right, theoretical particle physics, is like never not math, right? And maybe what like the, I don't know, felinologist does, like someone who just studies cats, right? Like very little math involved, right? Doesn't mean they're doing different things in the sense of like one is doing science and one is not. Doesn't mean that they're doing different things in the sense that one is doing natural science or natural philosophy and one is not. It just means that they're doing the same sort of thing in different ways for Aquinas. So the suggestion is just this. I wonder whether this highly flexible, highly variable account of the ways that we can think scientifically might offer us a principled approach to not only the differences between the hard sciences and the soft sciences, but also to different degrees of mathematical formalism within the hard sciences. And I really do leave that as a question mark for you guys, the scientists, to tell me, the philosopher, if any of this seems like it might overlap in ways that are striking and interesting. So, thanks.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.